Christ wants to be in the middle of the suffering, and these can be very dark places where we bring the light of Christ into these dark places. And it can be challenging as a mental health minister to accompany that poor person who's, you know, their thoughts are disordered, they're in great despair, to accompany them and be with them.
Welcome to EWTN News In Depth. Alarming new health statistics show the crisis of suicide deaths in America has reached new levels. Psychologists say the record high, as bad as it is likely dwarfed by the even higher number of people contemplating suicide. A belief in God and a solid grounding in Catholic teaching do not make those suffering from mental stressors immune to suicide, as Mark Irons reports.
Suicide directly affects individual lives and families, including those with a strong faith.
We went to church every Sunday and all the holy days and everything like that. We were Catholic school trained, everything. So
for Bishop John Dolan of the Diocese of Phoenix, the Catholic faith was a big part of growing up, but so was suffering. Throughout the course of his life, three of his siblings and a brother-in-law have died by suicide.
It certainly impacted my life.
Bishop Dolan draws attention to one of the misperceptions people might have, that someone who took their own life must not have prayed or had faith. But that's not true.
My sister Mary had a great devotion to St. Therese of Lisieux. She had a love for the Lord, you know. But she also struggled. I've never met a person who tried to live as much as she tried to live. And that was a daily occurrence, trying to survive.
Mary's story is a reminder of the real-life struggle people with mental illness can face. And by sharing his own grief and experience with suicide, Bishop Dolan has given others the chance to come forward, share similar stories, and seek healing.
It has allowed other people to sort of come out of the dark.
His witness comes at a needed time. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, deaths by suicide have reached unprecedented levels. New data shows nearly 50,000 suicide deaths in 2022, the highest number ever recorded in U.S. history. The Catholic Church provides clear teaching about the dignity of human life and the need to preserve it. The Catechism states, "It is God who remains the sovereign master of life. We are obliged to accept life gratefully and preserve it for His honor and the salvation of our souls." The latest CDC numbers on suicide call into question how serious society is about preserving life.
We really haven't made much progress in bringing the death rate from suicide down.
Deacon Ed Schoner, the president of the Association of Catholic Mental Health Ministers, believes there's a stigma surrounding the issue of suicide, leaving people afraid to address it.
A lot of it, of course, relates to mental health and mental illness. A lot of it relates to feelings of despair and hopelessness. And I think all of those things frighten people to a certain extent, or I think there might be a tendency to think it's the person's fault. So as a society, we're not putting the resources into understanding and researching this and getting the death rates down.
Like Bishop Dolan, the issue is personal for Deacon Schoner. His daughter, Katie, who struggled with bipolar disorder, died by suicide in 2016. Schoner was very open about Katie's struggle in the obituary he wrote for her, and people responded.
I heard from thousands, tens of thousands of people about the need for a ministry in the area of mental health and suicide.
It inspired Deacon Schoner, in collaboration with Bishop Dolan and others, to start his organization in 2019. The Association of Catholic Mental Health Ministers hopes to develop more resources within the church. There is still much work to do.
What we're trying to do is to have a mental health ministry within the life of a parish that would just be kind of a routine ministry, like grief support or prison support or young adult ministry, where we accompany people that are living with mental health challenges.
At this point, the group has a presence in only about 20% of all the Catholic dioceses in the U.S. Schoner thinks what could prevent this type of ministry from catching on in faith circles is a false idea about mental health and suicidal thoughts.
That perception that good Catholics, this doesn't happen to good Catholics, and therefore they feel excluded by the church, or they can't talk about it in church circles, they have to keep it quiet.
That misperception is similar to what Bishop Dolan shared. And we spoke with another priest who believes there might also be a misunderstanding of Catholic Church teaching about the souls of those who have died by suicide.
What happens to them after death?
Father Timothy Graff in the Archdiocese of Newark says those who have lost a loved one might express concerns about their salvation.
Are they condemned? You know, is this, you know, they're living in hell forever? Is this such a grave sin? And they're so culpable that there's no chance for salvation.
For clarity, he directs people back to the Catechism of the Catholic Church, which states, Grave psychological disturbances, anguish, or grave fear of hardship, suffering, or torture can diminish the responsibility of the one committing suicide. We should not despair of the eternal salvation of persons who have taken their own lives. By ways known to Him alone, God can provide the opportunity for salutary repentance. The Church prays for persons who have taken their own lives.
It's a way of saying, God, you are merciful, and I want to live in that mercy.
Bishop Dolan says the work of bringing Christ to others starts now. He calls on Catholics to support those who suffer or feel shame and isolation.
I think church has just got to be the place for people to gather.
And he asks those who need help to reach out to people around them instead of suffering in silent prayer.
It's not me and God. I'll never get there. God put us on earth with other people for a reason.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in Depth.
And even those who are expected to take care of the rest of us are susceptible to suicide. Studies show medical doctors are more likely to die by suicide than the general population. According to Medscape's Physician Suicide Report in 2023, an estimated 300 to 400 doctors die by suicide each year in America. Facing professional pressure, intense hours, and burnout, that is more than double the rate of the general population. The research says 9% of male American physicians and 11% of women doctors have reported suicidal thoughts. To discuss these alarming suicide statistics, we're joined by psychologist Melinda Moore. Dr. Moore is a leading voice working at the intersection of faith and suicide prevention. She trains clergy, faith leaders, clinicians, and PhD students on ways to combat this dilemma and how to counsel the loved ones left behind. Thank you so much for joining us, Melinda. The shorter days of fall and winter tend to be blamed for increased depression, but what are the most common causes of depression and anxiety?
Well, I mean, I think depression and anxiety are complicated, and you can't necessarily link depression and anxiety. I do want to say that with suicide. What we know about sort of seasonal depression is that it's thought to be linked with the lower amount of light in the northern hemisphere during the winter months. But when it comes to suicide, it's a much more complex cause or reason behind it.
Well, you've seen a lot of studies, I'm sure, that show TikTok and social media platforms may have harmful effects on children and families, often leading to potential situations of suicide. A Gallup study noted teens on average spend 4 to 5 hours a day on social media. Hours. Do you see these effects having a link to increased suicide rates?
You know, I know there have been studies, some large longitudinal studies of children and adolescents who spend more than 3 hours, showing some pretty poor health outcomes. But, you know, I think it's a mixed bag. I think also social media and these other resources that we get on, you know, the phone or on the computer also provide us connection, you know, needed connection and support, whether it's the Halo app or, you know, Calm or, you know, the UCLA Mindfulness Center. I mean, there are all sorts of wonderful apps, all sorts of wonderful opportunities for really good content also to come into our lives. You know, when I think about children, adolescents, I think about those who are in rural communities or who might feel disconnected from others. They actually get a lot of support. So I think it's an opportunity for parents to really get interested and engage with their children about the content that they're watching, that they're consuming, and also the number of hours that they're consuming it. But I wouldn't necessarily blame social media on the rise of suicide among adolescents.
I know many of us would say that they can always enjoy the content on the EWTN app. But you're a person of faith, and you've mentioned this fuels and affects your work. Have you always had your faith, and did it drive your decision to become a psychologist?
Oh, definitely. My faith was part of it. But, you know, like Bishop John Dolan and Deacon Ed Schoner, I'm also suicide bereaved. It was my husband who died by suicide a number of years ago. I was working in healthcare, public health, And that his death really changed the direction of my life. I got very curious about suicide prevention and then ended up going back and getting a PhD in clinical psychology at Catholic University of America. And so it really opened my eyes to the suffering around suicide and the fact that we really weren't addressing it, not just in faith communities, but we weren't addressing it in sort of popular culture and certainly in clinical training. And so I would say this experience of loss combined with my new faith. I was a new Catholic when my husband died by suicide. I would say those two things together really fueled my current profession and my current mission to train clinicians, but also to help forward faith communities and how they address and think about and become resources and really safe harbors for people who are in crisis, but then also for those individuals who've had the worst happen, and that is to lose a loved one to suicide.
That does sound like the worst. I'm so sorry for your loss, and I know the team joins me in expressing our deep prayers for your late husband. Now, you train church ministers who work with the faithful who have suicidal thoughts. Why is that training so essential to combating suicidal thoughts and suicide in general?
Yeah, you know, I think faith leaders, clergy, lay faith leaders of all kinds, not just Catholic, have a wonderful potential to demonstrate leadership. Not just how we talk about suicide, you know, at the funeral, let's say in the aftermath of the suicide, but also from the pulpit, you know, how to manage mental health crises and also how to reach out for help. I think so many people of faith somehow feel like this is a moral failing or some sort of a spiritual crisis, when in fact it very well may be a mental health crisis and they just need to get some help. You know, I talked with many, many faith leaders who knew that they really needed to be better equipped. But unfortunately, you know, only about 70% of clergy in this country go to seminary or don't go to seminary, rather. Only about 30% do. And those that do oftentimes get very little education on how to think about suicide or how to react or how to be a resource for people in their faith communities. And so I think there's a real dearth of knowledge and training, and we need to do a better job. I know that I have been involved with a number of individuals on the Faith Communities Task Force for the National Action Alliance, but I've also been part of a group of people who are really working at the forefront of faith and suicide prevention. And we've actually partnered with CAMS Care, which is a suicide-focused treatment training company. It's actually offering a virtual training for clergy, faith leaders of all kinds, not just Catholic.
Well, important to get them to recognize the signs and help people get the help that they need. NPR recently featured a Columbia University psychologist who said faith absolutely affects mood and disposition, and that it makes you happier and able to cope and be more resilient. You talked about how this might be so or it might not be so. It's definitely not a moral failing to be depressed. But do you ascribe to this position of faith as a fuel for joy and happiness as well?
No question about it. Faith gives us meaning in the best of times. And in the worst of times, it sustains us. It's life-saving. I know it was for me. But I think also some of the practices in faith, whether it's prayer, whether it's going to a service, these are all very life-affirming and help us understand, you know, that we do have internal resources to help us, but there are other, you know, resources external to us that can also help us. They sustain us. You know, prayer is a very much a meditative practice. You know, we talk a lot about meditation in, you know, popular culture and secular culture and psychology, but prayer is very much a meditative practice. And then, of course, when we participate in a service, you know, we know from research, Dr. Karen Mason's done some seminal work in this area, that, you know, it's not just the feeling of belongingness that really helps individuals who participate in a service, but it's that practice of shared values. So I think there are a number of things in a practice of faith that can help us not just sustain us, but also make us happier and more joyful, and certainly giving meaning to our lives.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Melinda. Still to come on EWTN News In Depth, the fallout of war, updates on Ukraine and Israel, and a milestone anniversary in the quest for human rights. And sparks fly in this week's Republican presidential debate. And this.
Oh, get in there.
Did he or did he not set a world record? A parish priest tries to establish basketball dominance on the playground. The Hoop Scoop coming up.
For the first time since the passage of a war crimes law 30 years ago, the United States is filing war crime charges against four Russian soldiers accused of torturing an American in the war in Ukraine. The soldiers, who remain at large, allegedly interrogated and threatened to kill the American citizen, even firing a bullet near his head in a mock execution. The American was living in Ukraine at the time of the Russian invasion. The atrocities occurred in April 2022.
These charges against four Russia-affiliated military personnel are the Justice Department's first criminal charges under the U.S. War Crimes Statute. They are also an important step toward accountability for the Russian regime's illegal war in Ukraine.
In the meantime, on Wednesday, President Joe Biden urged Congress to approve military and economic assistance for Ukraine, saying the situation is dire and cannot wait. U.S. funding for Israel is also still pending. We're 2 months into the Israel-Hamas war, which began with the October 7th attacks and capturing of about 240 hostages by Hamas. It escalated days later with Israeli airstrikes on Gaza and an eventual ground offensive. According to a rare photo released this week, the Israeli government claims five of the 11 Hamas leaders featured have been killed. Since the humanitarian crisis is worsening in Gaza, as the fighting in the war between Israel and Hamas expands into the southern portion of the Strip. It is the same area to which Palestinian evacuees from the north had fled. As the war grinds on, relatives of those still held hostage met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his war cabinet, demanding more emphasis be put on gaining their release.
We have no time. Each day that passes by, they are dying slowly each day. We need to get them out immediately, whatever the price might be.
The meeting was contentious, with several of those in attendance reportedly yelling shame at Netanyahu for what they perceived as his emphasis on the continued fighting and a detachment from concerns about the hostages. For analysis on this situation, we welcome again Alberto Fernandez, the vice president of the Middle East Media Research Institute and a former ambassador with the U.S. State Department. Alberto, welcome back. First, let's make sense of the casualties in Gaza. Our viewers know we're talking about a very small area of land, a strip 25 miles long and maybe 6 miles wide. The Israeli offensive has pushed Palestinian civilians into a small pocket of land with few supplies close to the border with Egypt. How can these civilians be protected?
Well, it's an almost impossible situation for civilians to be protected in a war in such a small area. There are going to be civilian casualties, and there have been thousands of civilian casualties. The numbers may vary, and Hamas plays games with numbers, but there's no doubt that the death toll and the suffering is tremendous. There's no doubt about that.
And the UN Office Coordinating Humanitarian Aid says its effort is near collapse, as ground fighting in the south has made delivery near impossible. But Prime Minister Netanyahu announced earlier this week that Israel will allow more aid to prevent humanitarian collapse. Do you think this will actually happen?
Well, it's a strange kind of war in the sense that for most of it, hundreds of trucks with food and medicine and fuel have come in, which is not an ordinary thing that happens in a war. Meanwhile, Hamas has been able to fire 11,000 rockets into Israel. So clearly they have fuel and they have food for their fighters. So it's a bizarre situation. It's a great human tragedy. It's also a strange type of war that's being waged with these strange rules and strange exceptions that are usually not seen on the battlefield between two belligerents.
And the hostages are a big part of that. We'll hold on that for a second, because I do want to talk to you about the accounts of the violent sexual crimes committed by Hamas against Israeli women hostages. We're 2 months into the war. People forget how unbearable it is to read these accounts. Is it possible that international groups are going to condemn Hamas for this?
It seems that some of them, a couple of months afterwards, decided to condemn this. Their silence was damning in the first few weeks. But I know the UN and some of them eventually, a really, really long time ago, and after many noticed their damning silence, came forward and said something about it. But, better late than never, I guess. But, of course, the problem with this is it generates distrust by one side of the fighting, meaning the Israelis, thinking that these international organizations are biased and that they have their own agenda.
There's distrust from the international community as well where it comes to the protection of women. But now we're weeks into the release of some of these hostages, and their testimonies are really starting to come out. The smiling faces that were relieved to come home and were waving are now sharing these harrowing experiences. How will these stories affect the ongoing war, Alberto?
Well, the truth comes out. And so we've learned, for example, that Hamas drugged at least some of these hostages as they were being released to make sure that they were placid and smiling and all of that. And of course, we know that the fighting restarted when Hamas refused to release the women that remain in captivity. And both the U.S. government and the Israeli government have said that was because it was very, very likely that these women, these young women, teenagers in their women in their early 20s, were being sexually abused by Hamas. And that's why Hamas was so concerned about not releasing them that it preferred to go back into the war rather than just releasing them and giving the people of Gaza a few more days of peace, a few more days to recover.
It's a real shame. The Israeli Defense Forces, though, have released images of Palestinian men being detained, claiming they're suspects of attacks or Hamas agents. They were forced to strip to their underwear and kneel on the street in case they were wearing explosives on their bodies. An Israeli military spokesman said that they will all be questioned to sort out who's who and to gain information. Alberto, what do these images indicate? Online, it's hard to understand whether this is some kind of an end or just the beginning of more.
Well, of course, these images are being manipulated by everybody, right? They're being manipulated by the pro-Hamas crowd to, as if it's something extraordinarily bad or terrible, when actually, you know, checking that soldiers don't have weapons or don't have bombs wrapped on their persons is relatively common in warfare. So it's been played up that this is horrible. The Israelis are also playing it up, of course, showing that these guys didn't want to fight, that 150 Hamas fighters decided to give themselves up rather than be killed in the fighting. So images have power. We saw at the beginning of the war, Hamas used the images of victims, of dead people, of this young woman, half-naked woman in the back of a pickup truck. So both sides use images for their own reasons.
Visual terror in addition to physical terror. Well, we are going to keep our eyes on the developing events of this war and our prayers for peace. Thank you so much, Alberto.
Thank you.
There's much more ahead. We'll be right back.
They're afraid to offend. And
see,
let me tell you something. If you're afraid, if you're afraid to offend Donald Trump, then what are you going to do when you sit across from President Xi, you sit across from the Ayatollah, you sit across from Putin? You have to be willing to offend with the truth.
Next, fireworks from the fourth Republican primary debate as the candidates compete for your vote to become the next commander-in-chief. And the president's home this Christmas season. EWTN News In Depth gets a tour of this year's White House decorations and a lesson on the history of its nativity scene when we return.
I don't question her faith, but I question her authenticity. And I think that's deeper here. Identity politics. This new religion that says your race, your gender, and your sexuality are your identity. It is anti-American.
The gloves come off in the fourth Republican presidential debate this week in Alabama, with discussions on faith and ideology. As the first election draws closer, the comments got sharper as the remaining candidates compete for your vote. Once again, the Republican elephant in the room was that the frontrunner did not participate in debating the issues, choosing to participate in a town hall with Sean Hannity the night before instead. Former President Donald Trump leads his GOP rivals by double digits in the polls. He chose to skip the event. But this debate made sure he was not ignored.
Ambassador Haley, do you support President Trump's plan for ideological screening?
Well, I don't think that you have a straight up Muslim ban as much as you look at the countries that have terrorist activity that want to hurt Americans. You can ban those people from those countries. It's not about a religion.
I'm in this race because the truth needs to be spoken. He is unfit. This is a guy who just said this past week that he wants to use the Department of Justice to go after his enemies when he gets in there. I mean, the fact of the matter is, he is unfit to be president, and there is no bigger issue in this race, Megan, than Donald Trump.
Father Time is undefeated. The idea that we're going to put someone up there that's almost 80 and there's going to be no effects from that, we all know that that's not true. And so we have an opportunity to do a next generation of leaders and really be able to move this country forward. We also need a president that can serve two terms. I don't think Donald Trump, I think he's going to have, I don't think he'd be able to get elected. The Democrats want him to be the nominee. We see that. They are going to turn the screws the minute if he got the nomination.
But do you think he's mentally fit to be president?
I think we need to have somebody younger.
This was the last Republican National Committee-sponsored debate of the season. Though late this week, CNN and ABC each announced they would be hosting debates next month. The first election of the cycle will take place on January 15th, with the Iowa caucuses, followed shortly thereafter by the New Hampshire primary on January 23rd. Whoever becomes the next president will have many weighty decisions to make. But one thing the president will not be in charge of is the annual White House Christmas decorations. That is a decades-long tradition directed by the White House Historical Association with input from the First Lady. This year, the association's president gave EWTN News a private tour, including a look at its nativity scene, installed 60 years ago by Jackie Kennedy. Correspondent Colin Flynn takes us inside.
Welcome to the White House, and one of the most beautiful places at Christmas time. Here in the East Wing of the White House, the decorations are incredible. Every room you enter has a different theme, a different look, a different feel, all with one thing in common, the magic of Christmas. And this year, we're getting a VIP tour of Christmas at the White House from Mr. Stuart McLaurin.
Stuart, this is beautiful.
I know, it's really pretty as you look back over and you see all the wreaths that are on the windows.
Yes.
All the way around the White House. What I love is coming in and you see the little children around and their eyes light up and they just want to reach out.
The White House, they just like the toys and the decorations.
Right. And they want to reach out and grab that gingerbread house and take a bite out of it. So.
And if anyone knows about the history of Christmas at the White House, it's Stuart McLaurin. He's the president of the White House Historical Association.
Stuart McLaurin, it is great to see you.
Welcome to the White House, Colm.
This is incredible. How beautiful is this Christmas at the White House?
Well, it's always special to be here, but there's no more special time than Christmas. Christmas is a family-centered, home-centered holiday, and the White House is the home to our president and his family. And in a sense, it's a home that belongs to all of America and all of the American people. And so to have it decorated and festive and special is really a wonderful thing.
Now, Stuart, when did this tradition of decorating so beautifully the East Wing of the White House, when did this begin?
Well, it has had many iterations over the years. The earliest celebration of Christmas at the White House was actually in Christmas of 1800,
wow,
when John and Abigail Adams had first moved into the White House. It was a very modest type of Christmas. Of course, it's extremely elaborate today, and it seems to get more so every year. But it was in the presidency of Dwight Eisenhower that the state floor began to be decorated with a number of Christmas trees. This year, there are 98 Christmas trees involved in the decorations. And then it evolved more and more and more until we're here at Christmas 2023, and it's probably the most spectacular ever.
It's magical.
It's magical. In fact, that's the theme,
really?
Magic, wonder, and joy.
This year, First Lady Dr. Jill Biden decorated the East Wing specifically with children in mind.
The magic, wonder, and joy of the season.
And walking through the halls, there are toys, sweets, a bed ready for the night before Christmas, 34,000 ornaments, and in the blue room where we're standing, a very special Christmas tree.
Mrs. Kennedy is is joined by the president in the blue room for picture taking in front of the executive mansion's Christmas tree, an 18-foot balsam inspired by the tree in the Nutcracker Suite.
The idea of having a themed Christmas started in 1961 with the Kennedys. First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy picked the theme of the Nutcracker. And little did anyone know that just under 2 years later, the presidential Christmas card would not be mailed out, and instead almost a million cards of condolences would come to the First Lady. But when in the White House, Jacqueline Kennedy made sure that the true meaning of Christmas was at the center of the decorations when she installed a very special nativity scene.
Very special. Actually, this nativity scene became part of the permanent White House decorations in 1967 during the Johnson presidency. But initially in 1961, there was a loaned creche of a Neapolitan 18th century Italian carved wood creche, over 40 pieces.
Wow.
And it is now, since 1967, every year, it is in the East Room of the White House.
Beautiful.
It is one of what I think are the centerpiece elements that are the iconic traditions in the White House decorations every year.
And that very same nativity scene is still here today.
I felt that I'd like to bring our own personal family feeling. How do you like it?
Now, Stuart, from studying the history and the beauty of Christmas at the White House over the years, what are the moments or the years that stand out to you as being extra special and extra memorable?
Well, you know, during the time that we've had been decorating the White House for Christmas, we've had times of war, times of peace, times of economic thriving and economic downturn. And the White House has tried to maintain a feeling of Christmas spirit.
Keeping the Christmas spirit alive in the White House by showing off the Christmas tree.
A White House Christmas tree.
Singing carols. Cooking.
I love the gingerbread house.
And even a surprise call from the president to see what Santa is bringing.
What's Santa going to get you for Christmas?
And Stuart, finally, for you personally, you get to come through here each Christmas and see the beauty. What is your favorite thing of Christmas at the White House?
Well, it's really just like seeing what the decorations are going to be. Dr. Biden has taken great interest in these decorations and in making them special. But to see it magically and wonderfully and joyfully through the eyes of a child, and I think she's achieved that beautifully. As for me, I like to see what the iconic Christmas tree is going to be in the blue room. Always interested in the gingerbread house because that's a very special part of the story. But I go back to the creche and the meaning of it all and how that is so beautifully depicted there in the East Room of the White House.
Stuart, it's been a pleasure and thank you so much.
Well, the pleasure has been mine, Colm. Thank you so much.
At the White House, Colm Flynn, EWTN News in Depth.
In just a few minutes, we continue our celebration of Christmas when we introduce you to an artisan who depicts the more humble aspects of this Advent season, a woodcarver honoring his Catholic faith with his nativity scene creations. That's coming up. But next, important headlines in the Week in Review. News about the long-standing Senate hold on military promotions tops the Week in Review. The dispute over the Pentagon's abortion travel policy had paralyzed promotions in the upper ranks of the military for 10 months. This week, Senator Tommy Tuberville released his hold on hundreds of military promotions. He had objected to the military allowing time off and travel reimbursement for service members seeking abortions. The Alabama senator faced mounting pressure over his holdout from both sides of the aisle, who believed his actions were impacting military readiness and national security. Tuberville told reporters that he ran out of options.
I can't win. And again, I'm still thinking about the unborn. I'm thinking about the military people that need to be promoted. It's been a year for a lot of them. It's been a long time.
Within hours, the Senate voted to promote the hundreds of military personnel who had been stuck in limbo. But Tuberville is keeping his hold on new command assignments for a handful of key four-star generals who will have to be voted on individually. The abortion policy changes Tuberville had demanded did not happen. Pope Francis offered prayers and condolences this week after a bombing left four dead and dozens injured during a Catholic mass in the Philippines. The attack took place at a state university in Marawi, a city with a large Muslim population. The bomb went off right in the middle of mass on Sunday, sending the students and teachers in attendance running. Police later identified two members of a pro-Islamic State militant group as bomb suspects. The last criminal case against Theodora McCarrick hangs in the balance after a competency exam deemed him, once again, unfit to stand trial. This just months after another charge was dropped in Massachusetts. The 93-year-old former cardinal was removed from the clerical state in 2019 following several accusations of sexual abuse of minors and seminarians. If this case in Wisconsin is also dismissed, McCarrick could avoid criminal penalties once and for all, though he still faces civil suits. After more than 2 years, the trial against Cardinal Angelo Becciu could be coming to a close very soon. He's the highest-ranking Vatican official to ever be tried by lay judges in the Vatican court. This week, Becciu's defense team once again claimed he's innocent of charges that he mishandled millions in Vatican funds and argued that the prolonged and high-profile trial has caused the cardinal what they call enormous suffering. Closing statements will be heard next week, and a verdict is expected before Christmas. We mark an important milestone this weekend. December 10th is the 75th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Drafted by United Nations representatives and proclaimed in 1948, this declaration became the first of its kind to call for a universal protection of every person's fundamental right to life, liberty, and security of person. Not merely words on a piece of paper, the Declaration has paved the way for the adoption of more than 70 human rights treaties around the globe and has been translated into hundreds of languages. To discuss the history, legacy, and importance of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights on its 75th anniversary, we welcome Professor Habib Malik. He is a senior fellow on Lebanon and Middle Eastern Christians with the Philos Project and works for the Charles Malik Institute. Habib, welcome to the show. The 75th anniversary of the Declaration of Human Rights is significant for many reasons, but it also has Catholic roots. In the wake of two world wars, the world came together to protect human rights using language that affirms human dignity, something, a concept that's very, very Catholic. How does faith play a part in this definition of human rights?
Well, first of all, it was truly a universal effort by the international community. And it's important to keep that in mind. The work before the actual crafting of the declaration involved a committee that was organized by UNESCO to canvass across cultures to see if there is a basis for shared universal rights. And the good news came at the end that there is such a basis. Also, I think the composition of the Human Rights Commission itself was very varied and very international, bringing in all sorts of viewpoints. Now, you mentioned the faith or Christian angle. That's a very important one. I think, in all humility, my late father, who was quite steeped in Catholic philosophy and theology, in particular Thomas Aquinas and the medieval scholastics, as well as, of course, the ancient Greeks like Aristotle, he managed in the discussions in the Human Rights Commission and then also in the formulation of specific articles to inject elements that are very similar to the Catholic social concept of subsidiarity.
Yes.
And he emphasized what he called the intermediate institutions in society, the family, the church, the school, the association, the syndicate, the small group of close friends, etc. What we today generally refer to as civil society.
Mm-hmm.
Those are very important elements of Catholic subsidiarity that actually serve to cushion the individual from the overbearing pressures of the state. And if you recall, the Soviet Union at the time, which had representatives in the Human Rights Commission, was very much bent on undermining the individual, promoting the state, and at the end of the whole process of actually trying to scuttle the whole enterprise of coming up with a Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But Charles Malik, my late father, who had studied Marxism very well and knew all of the elements of dialectical materialism and Marxist philosophy, was unsparing in his speeches in actually dismantling and refuting that materialist ideology
Absolutely, and we're so grateful for that legacy, and it's so personal for you, talking about your father in this way. I want to note that he also drafted Article 18, the specific language around freedom of religion and freedom of conscience. You talk about the international community that came together. Often now, that's used to create freedom from religion, a really perverse turn that pushes religion into our homes and nowhere else. What was he thinking? What did he propose in the spirit of freedom?
Well, he was the product of perhaps the golden age of 20th century Lebanon, when freedoms were thriving, when there was very active pluralism here. Many of his classmates were Muslims and Jews, in addition to being Christians. And many of his students later on in philosophy at the American University were of that diverse kind of background. So for him, freedom of conscience, freedom of religion was very important. And the way he articulated Article 18 was having that in mind, not only the private practice of religion, but also the public practice. And perhaps most significantly, he insisted on inserting the clause, the right to change one's religion. Right. That was very important, although it did cause a bit of a problem with the Saudi delegation at the time, but with some backroom lobbying, my father and a couple of others managed to convince the Saudi delegation not to cast a negative vote because of this clause when the time came to vote on the Universal Declaration, but rather to abstain if they can't vote for it positively. And that's what happened.
It's a critical right that we definitely see the value of today, especially with world wars. How do you see the expansion on a totally different but related way of human rights to include rights that are not named in this initial declaration that was so hard fought, namely the right to abortion for women or environmental rights? Did your father address the potential dangers of enumerating all kinds of rights and kind of stuffing in additional rights to the original draft and enumeration?
Well, let me tell you this. He tried but failed to do two things. First of all, in Article 1, to introduce where it says endowed, it doesn't say endowed by whom. He tried to say endowed by the creator, and that didn't go through because they felt it wasn't inclusive enough. Mm. The other attempt was he tried to introduce an article on the rights of minorities. And that didn't work either, because this was the period of decolonization and all of the big powers didn't want to open up that Pandora's box at that point. But, you know, there's a silver lining there related to your question. And it is that seeing what has happened since then, the proliferation of all sorts of what I would call pseudo minorities as opposed to integral minorities. I mean, I think communities that are rooted for centuries in their homelands and that are exposed to persecution and maybe genocide, these would be integral minorities. But groups that simply insist on additional rights because of their own peculiar self-definitions, and then they want more rights, usually in democratic societies where all citizens should enjoy the same rights, those would be pseudo-minorities. And in a sense, it's good that that Pandora's box wasn't opened at the time, seeing what kinds of newfangled rights have emerged today.
Which we know are quite dangerous.
Yes, exactly. You mentioned abortion. I mean, 5 minutes ago, metaphorically, that would have been considered as an abuse of rights. Euthanasia is another one.
That's right.
Assisted suicide is a third. I mean, in other words, there are things coming at us, wolves in sheepskin, if you like, that approach us as new rights when in fact they are abuses cloaked as pseudo rights.
Absolutely.
And I think for that reason, I think the Universal Declaration must remain exactly as it is without any additions, because you open that door and there's no knowing where you will be able to close it. And it should stand as a reference for universal rights across time and across cultures.
Well, we certainly agree with the integrity of the document that you've described. I want to ask you quickly, because I know you are in Lebanon right now, and the conflict in the Israel-Hamas war is obviously related to the power of Hezbollah in your backyard. Tell us what it's like for you there now.
Look, we are all here as Lebanese watching what's going on very apprehensively. Because the last thing we want is for this war to spread northwards and for escalation to take place. Lebanon is already in a very precarious situation. We had an economic collapse. We had a Ponzi scheme perpetrated on all of us by the ruling corrupt mafia. We have Iran's proxy Hezbollah, which is protecting that mafia here in Lebanon. And so Lebanon is in no way equipped or ready to sustain an escalation of this war. That's one thing. The other thing, I can assure you that a majority of Lebanese are opposed to Hezbollah's taking, you know, military matters into their own hands, launching wars, dragging the country into unwanted conflicts. I can tell you most of the Christians, most of the Sunni Muslims, certainly most of the Druze, and a good portion of courageous Shiites reject this. And so this is perhaps not very well appreciated or known in the West, but it should be. Lebanon should not be seen as synonymous with Hezbollah at all. And we're hoping that once this war somehow is settled or ends, that no post-war settlement will come at Lebanon's expense, meaning deepening Iran's entrenchment in Lebanon as some kind of reward for them not escalating further or whatever. I think this will be terrible for Israel and for the West eventually, because it will come back to haunt them just as Gaza has come back to haunt them. And so really, we are sitting here and observing day by day what might happen. But a lot of people here are openly critical of Hezbollah's actions and its dragging of Lebanon into this kind of conflict.
Well, that's certainly an important declaration you just made, and we're grateful that you opened the eyes of the West and our viewers around the world on this. Thank you so much, Habib.
Thank you.
Presidents of several Ivy League universities testified before Congress this week, defending their responses to anti-Semitism on campus. The leaders from Harvard, Penn, and MIT discussed anti-Semitic incidents on campus before the House Committee on Education and the Workforce. The hearing reflected universities' struggle to balance free speech and student safety during campus-wide protests after Hamas's attack on Israel. All three presidents emphasized that their school codes of conduct do not allow for anti-Semitism, but Jewish students said more direct action must be taken.
Problematic speech needs to be countered with other speech and with education, and we are doing that. However, the right to free speech does not extend to harassment, discrimination, or incitement to violence in our community.
Jewish students do not believe that the MIT administration has done an adequate job to make students feel safe on campus. President Kornbluth, please let me go back to being a scientist. Let me go back to being a student. I don't want to have to keep advocating for Jewish student safety on campus. It's not my job. It's your job.
During the hearing, both students and alumni expressed anger over their president's refusal to openly condemn anti-Semitic speech. Many critics are calling for them to resign. The University of Notre Dame announced new leadership this week. Father Robert Dowd, Notre Dame's vice president, will become the university's 18th president. He replaces Father John Jenkins, who served as president for 19 years. Father Dowd will begin his tenure in July. Pope Francis has named three new auxiliary bishops for the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. Archbishop Nelson Perez and the Archdiocese made the announcement in a press conference on Friday. Philadelphia's new auxiliary bishops are Father Christopher Cook, Father Efren Esmilla, and Father Keith Kalinske, rector of St. Charles Borromeo Seminary, who joined EWTN News in Depth last year. We'll be right back with more news.
In his spare time, this is what he does. He, you know, listens to television in the morning, he listens to Mass, and then he goes to work.
His faith defines his life. The woodcarver who creates beautiful nativity scenes that inspire all those who know him. His story next.
Sometimes the most beautiful things are found in the simplest of places. In the small town of Homer, Nebraska, reporter Alan Holdren spoke with a man known for having a talent for wood carving. His handcrafted nativity sets brighten his community and shine a light on his deep devotion to Christ. Alan has his story in this week's Faith Journey in Depth.
Near the border where Iowa, South Dakota, and Nebraska come together, there's a simple farmhouse where a seemingly ordinary man makes the most extraordinary handcrafted woodwork in a corner of his basement.
I'm Paul O'Connor, and I'm a retired farmer. I was carving a little bit, I was bitten before, and then I thought, well, if I just like to make a nativity set, but then when I started to sell them, I thought that it would make people think of the Christmas, which is what the nativity set is. In the beginning, I just made one. Then after that, I started to make it more. Then I decided I'd try to sell them at a craft fair. Then I made about three a year. I enjoy making for people, enjoy them a lot. I know they ain't perfect, but it gets harder all the time for me. And I'm 89 years old, so, but I'll keep on for a while, yeah, as long as I can, I guess.
Self-taught, when he's not carving, Paul paints and does ink drawings as well, illustrating moments in his life, which are often connected to his faith.
There was the old Catholic church in Homer.
He bases the depictions on photos, recreating scenes like this one, the massive sculpture of Our Lady of Peace in nearby Sioux City. The nearly 90-year-old Army veteran is still very active. It's Sunday morning, and he's attending Mass at the St. Augustine Indian Mission St. Catherine Drexel founded in nearby Winnebago, Nebraska.
Paul O'Connor is one of those people that's just kind of in the background and one of the bedrock of every parish and every community. First of all, with his love for the community of Homer that he's from, that's been in his life even since before he was born in his family. But then also, you see in his artwork just the depth of his faith and how much he wants to share his faith and the beauty of God with people. I have admired him, especially the last 6 months when we stopped having weekend masses at his home parish of St. Cornelius in Homer. It was a very tough time for that parish and the parishioners, but he has remained faithful, and he's one of those people that he just wants to do whatever God wants him to do and be wherever God wants him to be.
Despite his reserved nature, Paul gets out into the community, even showing his nativity sets off today, as he does every year at an annual open house at the Dakota County Museum back in Homer. Ahead of Christmas, he also displays them next door at the O'Connor House, his great-grandfather's historic home. Paul is famous for his nativity sets around here.
He shows his love for the church with his hands, with his artwork and his carving and sculpting. I always give him Christmas cookies or strawberry pie and some different items, and you can't just give him something, he has to give you something. And my nativity set has come from Paul. 1 year at a time, he would give me one character, and that's how I got my nativity set. I have two nativity sets made by Paul O'Connor. The first thing that comes to my mind is the talent, but it also is the thought of his ability to see beyond just carving. He sees what it actually should mean to all of us. He put so much time and thought into these. He had no pattern to follow. He did it all on his own. Many of us take God for granted, and each one of his, he has brought that back. So when you go to pull this out and you go to set it up, you think about why we celebrate Christmas. We don't celebrate it for the gifts. We celebrate it for the birth of Jesus Christ.
And that seems to be Paul's unspoken message to those who see his work, to look forward to Christ's second coming as we remember his first coming every year. In Homer, Nebraska, Alan Holdren, EWTN News in Depth.
Now, good luck getting one of the nativity sets that Paul makes. The next ones are already promised to local people or local fundraisers. Finally today, another story from the heartland of America. Last month, in a series of challenges during the annual I Give Catholic fundraiser, parish priest Father Jared Conradi in Beloit, Kansas, just might have set a world record with the longest ever basketball shot by a Catholic priest on a playground. It only took dozens and dozens of tries. Enjoy the fun in our images of the week.
Oh, get in there. Come on.
All right, here we go. Who is it? St. Jude? St. Jude? Hopeless causes? We're getting bored.
Come on. Oh! Hey!
Is anyone counting?
It took 85 throws, but determination won out. A 76.9-foot basket by Father Conradi and more than $275,000 raised for the school. Even more when you count additional fundraising for the parish. Congratulations to St. John's Catholic Schools in Beloit, Kansas, for the seventh highest I Give Catholic fundraising total in the U.S. this year. And on that happy note, that does it for this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Montse Alvarado. Join us again next week as we continue to celebrate the Advent season with more news and reports important to your Catholic life.